here again. The skies above are clear again. Let us sing a song of cheer again. Happy days are here again. All together, shout it now. There's no one who can doubt it now. So let's tell the world about it now. Happy days are here again. Your cares and troubles are gone. There'll be no more from now on. Happy days are here again. The skies above are clear again. Let us sing a song of cheer again. Happy days are here again.
Leo Reisman, I'm Paul Bjerisch, this is Tube Talk, thanks for tuning in, classy music, enlightening conversations concerning antique radio reign here. You have reached the zenith of the independently produced fine radio experience. Thanks for being here. It's Friday night, it's 10 o'clock, it's WRCA, I'm Paul Bjerisch, we made it. You know, some people would tell you that radio is dead. We here at Tube Talk would say, nay, nay. Radio is alive and well, and we are proof positive. We stream on the net via the WRCA website and are also available on your mobile device with TuneIn or iHeartRadio. And, you know, I played that song, Happy Days Are Here Again, with good reason here. I've received an email. Ed from Delaware writes, why does my show not have a theme song? You know, I listen to your program. Why do you not have an opening theme song that is the same song every week on your program? Well, you know, that's a very good idea. And, you know, he also goes on to mention here, it may help people recognize that they found the program, you know, they've just tuned in or picked up the stream. And if they heard the same thing each and every week, well, you know, somebody who's an intelligent person running a radio program would probably adopt that suggestion. So, you know, that may be our opening song until we deem otherwise. We'll have to see about that. But, you know, if you have a suggestion, what you think might be a good opening or closing, maybe we should have a regular closing song. Frequently, programs would have a regular open and closing theme. It's a very common occurrence. You hear it on old-time radio shows, you hear it on old-time TV shows, even modern TV. We still have opening and closing songs. So let me know what you think. It's tubetalk1@gmail.com. Thanks, Ed, for writing in with your suggestion. It's probably a great idea. And hopefully, you know, we'll come up with something. I like all the songs. I like playing different music each and every week here. So I really enjoy just about everything, but I can see your point. You know, it would be something to hang your hat on. You know you arrived at Tube Talk. So we're going to look into that, and we may just run with that for a little while. So, Ed, your 2 cents is in the pot.
Hoppity, hippity, hippity, hoppity, hoppity, hippity, hop, mop, mop! you ever pass the corner, fourth and grand, where a little ball of rhythm's got a shoeshine stand, the neighbors gather round and then they clap their hand. He's a great big bundle of joy. He pops a boogie-woogie rag, the Chattanooga shoeshine boy. He charges you a nickel to shine one shoe. He makes the oldest kind of leather look like new. You feel as though you want to dance when he gets through. He's a great big bundle of joy. He pops a boogie-woogie rag, the Chattanooga shoeshine boy.
That cat is a hoy polloi.
It's a wonder that the rag don't tear. Man, the way this cat makes it pop.
Pop!
My! You ought to see him fan the air with his hoppity hippity hippity hoppity hoppity hippity
hoppity hippity.
He opens up for business when the clock strikes nine. He likes to catch them early when they're feeling fine. Everybody gets a little rise and shine with that great big bundle of joy. He pops a boogie-woogie rag, the Chattanooga shoeshine boy.
It's a wonder that the rag don't tear the way he makes it pop. Gotta see him fan the air
with his hoppity hippity
hippity hoppity
hoppity hippity hoppity hoppity. He opens up for business when the clock strikes nine. He likes to grab 'em early when they're feeling fine. Everybody gets a little rise and shine with that great big bundle of joy.
Ooh.
He pops a boogie-woogie rag.
Man, his feet doesn't drag.
Chattanooga shoeshine.
Chattanooga shoeshine.
He's my bundle of joy. Man, you know one thing. If you don't get your foot out of the way in time, this cat'll bear down right through the leather and manicure your toes. As great.
That's Mr. Frank Sinatra with the Chattanooga Shoeshine Boy. Thanks, Jimmy, for turning me on to that one. That's a good piece of music, and I have a Bing Crosby version of that we've played before. I've also heard, I believe, a Johnny Cash version of that same tune, and it's one of my faves. So thanks for bringing that one to my attention. It was fun.
Men, nothing takes it off like Noxzema medicated shave. Take it off. Take it all off. Nothing takes it off like Noxzema medicated shave.
The closer you shave, the more you need Noxzema. Noxzema medicated comfort shave.
Thank you.
That's the St. Louis Blues March by Tex Beneke and his orchestra. So let's take a stroll down the hall tonight. It's getting a little chilly out. We'll go sit in that nice, comfy, overstuffed chair down in that radio parlor. Very cozy. We'll close the windows because there is getting to be a little nip in the air. And let's see who's in the green room waiting to join us tonight. We are very pleased this week on Tube Talk to welcome back a returning guest. Olin Schuler joins us. He is the president of the Antique Radio Club of Illinois. Olin, thanks for being back with us. I appreciate it.
It's a great pleasure to be here today.
Well, hey, I'll tell you what. We had promised when we were talking up Radio Fest a little bit to have Olin back for a recap. So maybe you can tell us how it all went. I heard there was a good turnout, and there was a lot of fun to be had, and the theme of the 1938 being the 75th year in radio was a winner, too. How did it go?
Well, we thought that the results met our expectations. We were most pleased that it went as well as it did, and I was most happy with the half a dozen or so of the major committees that that held up their end of the activity in exceptionally fine manner. And each of the major events that we had on the roster were conducted and managed and turned out to be truly excellent.
Well, it sounds like all hands were on deck and everybody pitched in to do their part. Did you manage to? I know it's probably a whirlwind for somebody who's the president of the club that's sponsoring a three-day radio event, but did you happen to catch any of the presentations? Did you have a favorite?
I didn't get to see all of them, but there were a couple that were particularly outstanding, and of course one was for a fan of radio history. The presentation by Cam Trowbridge on Marconi in business and politics was most interesting, because this went into the life and times of Marconi in his personal life and his business life, and there was a political life there also.
Sure. Yep. There's a lot of politics that went on. Yeah, he's a fascinating figure, Marconi is. You know, there's the radio side of him, but then you talk about having the political side of him all, and I guess I guess his mom was pretty wired with the British aristocracy, and that played a great part in him getting up there and signing on the Admiralty to use some of his devices and all. And Cam does a very nice job. He's given those presentations at many different meetings and been invited to give it frequently. So I know it's a pretty polished presentation. He's a good speaker, and he knows his stuff. So that must have been a good one.
Yes, there was. And then there was a real flag waver that turned out. A fellow named Dale Boyce talked about Briggs and Stratton radio. Now, we associate Briggs and Stratton with gasoline engines.
Yes,
and
we do.
Lawnmowers. But there was a time in the early 1920s when they were well into early radio components and early radio receivers. And for the collectors out there that look down inside of the old early 1920s sets and see the name Basco on a component part, on a transformer or a coil or a grid leak assembly, that Basco stands for Briggs and Stratton Company.
Oh, that's pretty cool. That's something, you know, we learned something tonight. And, you know, and it's interesting, too, for somebody, you know, a lot of people who go, say, oh, you're going to go to this meet or this radio event, blah, blah, blah. Well, I've seen it all, you know. Every time I go to any meet, whether it's a radio set that I see, a person that I meet, I learn something. And for somebody who's looking for something a little different, you know, that's a great topic, Briggs and Stratton. Because all I really, I equate them with the lawnmower that I have now that's about 17 years old, and it starts every time, and I can't get rid of it because it runs so well. So yeah. if they were half as good as radio as they are with those small engines, they must have had some nice equipment in their day.
Well, they did, and now he was a double hero for our meet because he also had a very comprehensive display in our contest. That was a real flag waver because he covered about 3 years, the three or four major years of Basco's activity in early radio with some just outstanding display tables of early components and some very nice advertising ephemera with it that just made a fine display.
Well, you know, that's the type of thing that just makes it all worthwhile for showing up. And how was the overall theme? 1938 was a great year in radio. So
that was a very good year because that was the year, of course, of the famous Orson Welles War of the Worlds broadcast. It was also the year that brought us Edgar Bergen and Charlie McCarthy. It also was the year that brought us Bob Hope first in the big broadcast of 1938 movie, and then with the Bob Hope radio show following. And then there was another 1938 beginning for a swing band band leader by the name of Kay Kaiser.
Certainly familiar with him.
Who was the proprietor of Kay Kaiser's College of Musical Knowledge.
That's right. Praise the Lord and pass the ammunition.
That's right.
Well, you know, it's interesting because I read a horribly plagiarized Dave Bart's little piece when he listed a whole laundry list of programs that came out, and many of them very familiar, very memorable programs that came out in 38. And it was just sort of a watershed year. And, you know, we talked last week, we had a fellow on, and we talked a little theory, which we don't usually do, and we talked about the, you know, the development and the, you know, the incredible progress that radio made as far as expanding everywhere with the advent of the All-American 5 circuit.
Yes.
And those little radios, you know, especially during the Depression, you know, for a quarter down and 50 cents a month, you could bring one of those home and hopefully hang on to it if the repo man didn't catch up with you.
That's right.
But it made radio accessible to the masses in a way that it never was before. And then you see all of this entertainment roll out and all of the sporting formats that rolled out. And, you know, so it really was a great year to celebrate. So I'm glad that it went over well. And I'm sure there were a few Charlie McCarthy sets at the show as well.
Yes, there was a Charlie McCarthy display. Dave Bart had some items there. I did a display on Motorola radios from 1938. That was the year that Motorola went into the home radio business.
Yep, you had mentioned that previously. That was a big year for them.
And then right along with that, I included several storyboards of 1938 radio advertising that I was able to glean from radio retailing magazines.
Now, you know, just out of curiosity, who made that little Charlie McCarthy set? Was that a Stuart Warner product? That I don't. I should know that, but I don't. You know, so
I believe that was.
Was it an Arvin?
Might have been Sentinel.
Yeah, it might have been. Yeah, I mean, those are very collectible items, and it's, you know, right up there with the Arvin, the little radio that they had made for the Lone Ranger.
Yes.
So nice stuff, and it's something that people can relate to because they've seen those with all the radios that the collectors and the antique lovers see. You know, then the masses can latch on to something like that. It gives them a sort of a touch point that they can say, yep, that's right, Charlie McCarthy, and wow, he had his own radio.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
You know, so that's a great little point. It's a great entrance for somebody who's not into the world of radio to catch on to and get in.
Yes.
Now, you were telling me there was something about a thunderstorm. Now, when when did this happen?
Well, yes, this was, well, weather for the event was just great until about 3 o'clock in the afternoon on Friday. A thunderstorm rolled through and caused some excitement. It took down the vintage amateur radio tent.
Uh-oh.
And but didn't do any substantial damage. Some of the equipment had a little bit of fresh water spilled on it, but it looks as if nothing got into vital places and caused any real damage. I had a similar event or two with a couple of our sellers and some excitement down in the area where our donation auction items were being arranged, and several of us got together. I commandeered my pickup truck that has a bed cover on it and got it down there. And in the midst of the rainstorm, we were doing Praise the Lord and Pass the Ammunition.
Yep. Loading it up.
Getting radios out of harm's way,
as we say.
Out of the donation auction tent and into the back end of my truck. And we got that done just before about half of the tent collapsed.
Ugh.
Fortunately, it was into a vacant area, and all of our treasures for the donation auction were in the dry in the back end of the truck.
Very good.
I'll have to say, I never saw the back bumper of that truck sit as low as it did after we got everything in it.
But some good size sets in there. Well, you know, it's...
And then the next morning, sun was out. We were out there promptly, got everything back out of the truck, onto the ground, into the sunshine, and it looked as if nothing bad had ever happened to any of the materials, and we had a successful donation auction.
Well, you know, it's a tribute to that hale and hearty bunch that you guys are out there, that you didn't let it, pardon the pun, rain on the parade, and everything went
That's
off so
right.
well. So.
And now, through all of that, not one of our swap meet vendors left us.
Very good. See,
they
a devoted group.
They covered things up and rode out the day, and then were there selling again on Saturday morning. So we were very happy at the tenacity of our people.
Well, that's great. It sounds like overall it was a very nice event. It's a big thing for a lot of people. I know you get people who come up from Texas. How's Jim Sargent doing? How was the auction?
He's doing just fine. He is enjoying retirement. I also ran into him a week or two ago at the antique wireless meet out in Rochester. But I have to say about the Antique Radio Club of Illinois meet, the activity that stole the show was our banquet speaker. We had Jim Wades, who is the president of the Morse Telegraph Club, come in and talk about his work and his adventures working as a consultant in the filming of the movie Lincoln, in the filming of the telegraph scenes in the movie Lincoln, and in the telegraph scenes for the movie The Lone Ranger.
That's cool. I mean, that, you know, for people who say, why is any of this still relevant, you know, if for nothing else, you know, the historical link, you know, telegraphy and the Civil War, I mean, that must have been a great talk and technical development.
It held the attention of the entire audience through the entire talk, and we were pleased that that some of our sellers and folks who didn't necessarily come for the food part of the banquet wandered in through the side doors and were there for the talk. And he held the crowd with fixed interest through the entire presentation.
Well, I'll tell you what, if he did such a great job, maybe he'll be in the next movie. You know, maybe they'll give him a role, because it sounds like he stole the show.
Well, yes.
Well, I tell you what, we're going to switch gears here a little bit. Olin, in addition to giving us his recap on Radio Fest, and we got to say, see you there next year, because I'm sure it'll be even bigger and better than ever. It's just, it's a big event, and
it deserves.
We could talk all night about it, but we also wanted to cover a little something here. Olin was in Motorola for many, many years, and he had written an article that caught my eye in the Archie magazine. And, you know, Motorola, just as, you know, Motor is in the name, was a leader in developing AM radio for automobiles. And then, you know, they come out and darn it, they come up with a great-sounding FM radio as well. And you just have to guess who was one of the engineers involved in that project. Well, it was Olin Schuller. So, you know, from the company that brings you the most in AM car radios, now the most in FM car radios, it's Motorola. So, Olin, maybe you can give us a little background, because this was a big development. You know, for those of us who, you know, are old enough to remember when cars, you know, were exclusively AM radio, and that was what you had. And, you know, even into the 70s, I think my sister's car was AM only, and we got a little FM converter kit. We got one at Radio Shack. And that was big news, you know, because we had FM. But here's Motorola, and they come out with the Motorola FM900, a 7-tube FM car radio. And, you know, it's a great story. And, you know, what really motivated Motorola to come up and step up to the plate and hit that home run that was that radio?
Well, we will segue into that by saying that we had the electrical design engineer at Radio Fest this year as our guest of honor also.
Very nice. Now, that was the fellow who presented you with the set a little later on, wasn't it?
Yes.
Ray Schulenberg.
That was Ray Schulenberg.
And that's just another very nice part of that whole story, is that you got to hook up with him again.
Well, let's do just a quick recap of the early history of FM. The need for and the wish for static-free reception goes back to the 1920s, when radio stations weren't very powerful, and they were badly troubled in times of stormy weather with static. So static-free reception was desired, and Edwin Armstrong worked on this through the late 20s, and by 1934 had found a means of doing it. And between 1934 and 1940 was working with RCA and with others, and FM made its way into practical use, was licensed for operation by about 1941, and by the summer of 1941 there were there are about a half a dozen FM stations that were commercial stations, fully licensed and operating, in addition to a number of experimental stations that were also operating on the FM frequencies.
Yeah, and one of those was right out of Chicago. Zenith itself ran an FM station.
Yes, yes.
And I've seen some photos in their library of records, and they played a good deal of, interestingly enough, classical-type music, and they felt that that was, you know, their part in supporting, you know, the morale of the war worker. The production worker would have a little something to relax with. So that was right
yes.
there, right in Chicago. You know, just briefly here before we continue, my name is Paul Burish. The show is Tube Talk. We are here tonight with Olin Schuller from the Antique Radio Club of Illinois, and he's giving us a rundown on the development of the Motorola FM 900. And Olin, so we've set the stage. Then the war comes along, and everything kind of goes on hold because we're not building any radio sets at all, and World War II ends, and where do we go from there with FM?
Well, at the end of World War II, technology had developed and had advanced, and the FM broadcast band was moved from a region down around 40 megahertz up to its present location of 88 to 108 megahertz, and it was there that the post-war activity really began, and there was a substantial move into FM broadcasting. Most broadcasters also had an FM affiliate, and it came to market. But there were a couple of things that were realized, and some events there that didn't allow FM to grow rapidly and successfully at first. And that was a general lack of high-quality program source material, and also the need for better high-end equipment on the receiving end to appreciate it. The audiophiles of the time, who were dedicated into high quality broadcasting flourished. There was activity with large console radios, but that generally limited FM enjoyment to the home, to the living room or the den at home.
Yeah, and it was expensive too.
Yes, and then those that could hear FM on the smaller receivers were hard-pressed to see any real benefit because they sounded pretty much the same as the AM stations.
Sure.
And so FM kind of was falling on hard times from about 1948 into the mid-50s, and many of the early FM stations went dark because of inability to attract and maintain a large faithful audience.
Sure. Yep.
And by the mid 1950s, for example, I was in Kansas City going to school at the time, and we were down to one FM station in the town, and it was surviving by providing background music for the local city bus company.
sort of an early Muzak.
Yes. And so FM began to come back with the advent of multiplexing, which allowed Muzak systems to operate off of FM, and the promise of FM stereo. That system was known by the insiders that it was coming, and going into the late 1950s. FM was about bottoming out in its activity, and companies like Motorola were dropping FM radios from their new model lineup, particularly table models. FM was in a bit of trouble, and for example, there was a survey by Popular Electronics magazine asking the major manufacturers if they had plans to offer an FM car radio at any time, and Motorola was one who first answered no to that they weren't. But then folks inside the organization began to realize that with FM multiplex and with stereo coming, there might be a place for an FM car radio.
Sure.
And with that, in 1958, a project was authorized and design began.
Well, you know, Motorola FM car radios offer the finest programming available, crystal clear and virtually static-free. And, you know, sometimes the time just has to be right for the technology and for the marketing to really, you know, catch on with the public. I think the public was ready for something a little bit different. I mean, AM had been around for many, many, many years and was a trusted friend to a lot of listeners.
That's
but
right.
It sounds like things were ready for a little breakthrough.
And by that time, higher quality records were available, higher quality LPs.
Sure.
That were recorded to high grade tape masters, and high grade tape was available.
Mm-hmm.
And so by the late 1950s, broadcasters had something they
sure.
could work with as a standout.
You know, you think just not to digress, but you think about all of that stuff that RCA in particular started to do in the 50s, though, those high-fidelity recordings. They did it with
yes.
all the classic conductors and the Chicago Symphony and the Boston Symphony and, you know, even bringing popular recording artists in and doing that stuff. It sounds, those sound phenomenal even today, and when they had material that would sound so much better on the FM, things really started to click, I guess, huh?
By that time, good quality programming material was available. And so there was a decision for Motorola to enter the field and in a do-it-right mode. Now, there were converters that were around, but none of the car makers were offering FM as original factory installed equipment. Ford had a try at it in 1958 and 59 with an aftermarket system that could be installed by Lincoln dealers in Lincoln automobiles.
Mm-hmm.
But that offering only lasted for about two years and then faded away.
Well, you know, it sounds like, I was looking at some photographs that you had, certainly some of the ad copy, which I've been reading here as we go along here and talk about it. But I was impressed with the FM 900's design. You know, it's a flat, modular, very modular-looking set. It was a seven-tube set. And, you know, from what you were saying, it was so well-designed when it actually hit the test production lines. You know, other than some issues that later got ironed out with replacing the dial glass, the thing was almost flawless in design and went together so well. It is just a beautiful piece of engineering, and you know, it must have sounded great too. What did the guys think at Motorola when they first loaded that into a car and heard that? Somebody who had never heard FM before in a car, that must have been quite a thrill.
We thought it was great, and I was one of the first in our area to have that. I installed one of the early ones in a 1956 Chevrolet that I had, which happened to have a space right in the dashboard for a big 6x9 speaker that was furnished with the unit. So the FM 900 with a 6x9 speaker firing straight line out of the dashboard, not bouncing it off the windshield, but
mm-hmm.
straight out into the passenger compartment, really sounded good.
Well, you know, it just, and then I guess a lot of other manufacturers saw the light when this device became a success, and a lot of others jumped onto it. So it was really sort of a record development. It was something that hadn't been done before, and not only did Motorola do it, they did it right, and the sound must have been great. And then, you know, the ball really started rolling You know, a lot of folks, when they think about classic FM, they think of these public radio stations with great libraries of classical music and just how sweet everything sounds. And FM is still extremely popular today. And again, the biggest thing we run into up here in Boston, they just took the Red Sox off of a 50,000-watt AM station, moved them over to an FM station, and you know, the sound is quite good, but, you know, my only complaint is that it just doesn't have the reach that the AM had. You know, I used to be able to pick that up pretty much everywhere. So for the motoring public, though, what a thrill to now have concert-quality music in their car, and I'm sure the car manufacturers played that up to the max.
And that... And the broadcasters loved it because now they could have sales revenue from morning drive time and evening drive time.
Sure.
And that's what then made FM finally profitable.
Commercially successful,
correct. For the broadcasters who hung on through the hard times with it now easily available through an automobile radio saved the FM broadcasting industry, and over the years it grew from a situation where, like in our town in the early 1960s, there were only three FM stations that could be heard, and now we can hear three FM stations by tuning the dial, by just turning the knob about one half of one turn. Takes you through at least three, and then there's full population all the way up and all the way down.
Well, you know, and the other sidelight of all of this, too, is this burst of growth in the FM programming side of things. You know, that just made all of these, you know, one of my regular guests here is a enthusiastic European radio guy, so all the Grundigs and Sabas, you know, now they have something to sound spectacular with. In addition to that, Zenith had some extremely fine-sounding AM-FM radios that they produced right up into the late 60s. Some nice, very nice AM-FM sets. I am fortunate enough to have a couple, but they kept it going. Zenith did right there in Chicago for many, many years, and FM really helped them stay relevant.
I really need to mention the excellence of the design as was executed by Ray Schulenberg, who did the design work on this, to take a product where little was known about FM propagation into locations like parking garages and the shadows of big buildings downtown and the fringe areas out in the country. And one of his tasks was to develop the specifications. How good did this thing have to be, numbers wise, in order to satisfy the needs?
Yep, and nobody
so
would be
in the lead on doing the field work first to see how much sensitivity, where does the sensitivity limit have to be, where does the limiting limit have to be, and how good do the speakers have to be, then learn that and then go into the lab and
execute.
He was able to come up with a design that that went through startup and through the entire production run without a single electrical change.
Well, you know, the other thing is, too, it was very important that he do that and do it so well, because if you roll this thing out and it was a bust, and people didn't think it worked well, and, you know, when they turned the corner at 4th and Main and they lost their program, you know, it would have been a big black eye for FM, and certainly would have been a black eye for Motorola as well. Olin, you know, it's an amazing thing, but the clock here runs awful fast, and we could almost make this a two-part discussion. But you know what? We'll have you back on sometime, and we'll talk a little bit more about the engineering and design and the production line, because that in itself is a whole other big segment of this story. So I appreciate you being on. Thanks so much. Have a great night.
Thank you.
Take care, Olin. Bye-bye.
Good night.
All around the chimney top, the monkey chased the weasel.
The monkey thought 'twas all in fun. Pop goes the weasel. I've no time to wait or sigh. No patience to wait till by and by. Kiss me quick, I'm off, goodbye. Pop goes the weasel. Chased the weasel, oh weasel. Monkey laughed and laughed and laughed and thought it was all in fun, oh weasel. I've no time to wait or sigh. No time to wait till by and by. Kiss me quick, I'm off, goodbye. Up goes the weasel. Monkey thought 'twas all in fun, so pop, pop goes the weasel. I've no time to wait or sigh, no time to wait till by and by. Kiss me quick, I'm off, goodbye, pop goes the weasel. Pop, pop, pop goes the weasel. Pop, pop, pop goes the weasel. Pop goes the weasel.
Yo-ho, yo-ho, brushless or leather, boys, whichever use the notion.
50 cents for shaving cream, a dollar for the lotion.
Old Spice means quality, said the captain to the bosun. So look for the package with the ship that sails the ocean. Yo-ho, yo-ho.
Well, thank you, Olin Shuler, for being on the program tonight. It's guys like Olin that are little treasures. And it's so wonderful that they'll take some time to share their experiences and their knowledge with us. So it enriches the show, and we love to have a good guest on, especially somebody who's lived it, in addition to just restoring it. So, Olin, thanks again, and I didn't mean to make short on our presentation of the Motorola FM car radio. We'll get into that in a little bit more detail on future shows. It's always great to have something to talk about coming up. It makes it easier for me, the program director. That's what it's all about.
When I was just a little girl, I asked my mother, what will I be? What she said to me. Que sera, sera. Whatever will be. The future's not ours to see. Que sera, sera. What will be. When I grew up and fell in love, I asked my sweetheart, what lies ahead? Will we have rainbows day after day? Here's what my sweetheart said. Que sera, sera. Whatever will be. The future's not ours to see. Que sera, sera. What will be. Now I have children of my own. They ask their mother, what will I be? Will I be handsome? Will I be rich? I tell them tenderly. Que sera, sera. Whatever will be. The future's not ours to see. Que sera.
That's Doris Day with Que Sera, Sera. And that's from the film, the great Hitchcock film, The Man Who Knew Too Much. And I love the ending of that with the symphony and running around looking for the little boy and the cymbal clap and just, you know, Que Sera, Sera. That ought to be the motto for the show. That's the way we do things around here. So thanks for tuning in to Tube Talk. If you'd like to reach the show, it's tubetalk1@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you. Think of us as a radio couch at the therapy unit. You can lie down, tell us of your radio feelings. Are the radios piling up so deep you can't move from room to room anymore? It's okay. We know lots of people who have that problem. We can help you. Do you have too many sets to restore? So many that you just couldn't get to them all, possibly, in your lifetime. But you won't sell them or swap them either. Well, you know, lie down, relax, tell me all about it. We'll help you out. We really will.
Are you ready, Quartet? All right, let's go.
Drink to me, darling, not with thine eyes, but with fast blue ribbon gear. 'Cause if you toast me with fast blue ribbon, I'll know that your love's sincere.
The beer that is splendid is the beer that is blended from 33 fine brews. And if you'll serve me sparkling clear, perhaps your love, dear, I can't refuse.
You can serve it with cold cuts if you're too pleased. Serve it with a dab of tasty nippy cheese. Have a smooth refreshing and have no sauce. And anywhere they have the beer, the bottle is too far.
I'd run a million laps for a bottle of half blue ribbon.
Well, Al Jolson, he ain't, whoever was singing that thing. This is Ella Mae Morse with the Cow Cow Boogie.
Out on the plains, down your Santa Fe, I met a cowboy in the range one day, and as he jogged along, I heard him singing a most peculiar cowboy song. It was a ditty he learned in the city. Come-a-ta-ay-ay, come-a-ta-yip-li-ay-ay, get along, get hip, little doggies, get along. Singing his cow-cow boogie in the strangest way. Come-a-tie-ay-ay, come-a-tie-yip-tie-ay-ay. Singing his cowboy song. He's just too much. He's got a knocked-out western accent with a wild of touch. He was raised on local weed. He's what you call a swing half-breed. Singing his cow-cow boogie in the strangest way. Come a tie, come a tie, yip, tie, aye.
Yip, yip, he sings with a hollow touch. Yip, yip. it's cocked up, we'll give you the strangest way. Come a tie, aye, aye, aye.
Thanks, Ella May. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Good night, Tubnik America, wherever you are.